And I was like dancing with boys and dancing with girls and dancing with people who weren't boys or girls. And I was just like, this is magical and wonderful. And then I flew home right back into like, you know, pretending to be something I wasn't.
Hello, my name is Kay Anderson, and you are listening to Lost Spaces, the podcast that mourns the death of queer nightlife. Every episode, I talk to a different person about a venue from their past, the memories that they created there, and the people that they used to know. So sometimes being in a new location, surrounded by strangers and newness, and having a brand new futon that you need to figure out how to sleep properly on, is just the thing that you need to give you the bravery to embrace new things in your life. And that is exactly what happened for singer-songwriter Mia Byrne, who moved to San Francisco in 2015 to, you know, get a bit of freshness, get a change of scenery, and along the way threw herself headfirst into exciting new things. But you will have to listen on to find out what those exciting new things are. We got together to talk about The Stud. And, well, we did talk about The Stud. I promise you we eventually talk about The Stud. But in the rambly, incoherent way that we like to embrace on this show, we also talked about much more than that. And in particular, we talked a lot about the leather scene in San Francisco and how that's morphed and changed over the last decade. But that is probably enough from me. Why don't we hear from Mia and find out how she landed in San Francisco?
I lived in San Francisco between 2015 and 2023.
So why did you move?
Originally, it was because I had just gone through a messy divorce after I'd transitioned, and I decided I wanted a new start in a different place. And a lot of people I knew who are trans and from the internet, back when left book, as we called it back then, a lot of my activism community and folks from various organizing communities were out there, and I had met some people who were just like, hey, it's cheap to live out here, you know, access to healthcare is easy, I was going to lose my healthcare, and somebody offered me a place for $750 a month, and I was like, I can afford that. So I got on a plane wide-eyed, and they got sort of instantly thrown into the immediacy of the sort of leather scene in San Francisco, which was pretty intense and beautiful. And you know, there's a great picture of me, like the day I get off the plane at Oakland, being like, it's time for a new adventure. And I'm wearing like a cute little blue and like teal striped dress. And like 3 weeks later, I'm like stopping traffic in the middle of the street with like heavy eye makeup. Yeah, it's just crazy. It's just nuts. But it was just a world that was open for me and waiting for me. And, you know, I suppose that's some of what we're going to talk about today, is just the world that I sort of emerged into.
Well, wait. So are you saying that it corrupted you? No, that's probably not the right word. That, like, you hadn't dabbled in that scene prior to that?
It's interesting. When we talk about specifically about Lost Spaces, I think we can also talk about, like, the grand history of sort of kink and leather and how it intersects with the loss of space, right? Mm-hmm. So in New York at the time, I'd been sort of just like experimenting with kink stuff. I didn't quite know what I was into and things like that. And, you know, without going into too much detail of like stuff I'm into, I'm a leather person. I'm very proud of that.
Why not go into too much detail? Why not?
What will the children think? as I sit here staring at like a rack of like lots of leather. But more than anything, you know, the concept of leather as a historical community, I managed just to tap into this sort of last gasp of, not even a last gasp, but I sort of came out of this very traditional you know, leather community, whereas it was the first time that women, specifically trans women, had been like allowed into both the men's community and really been embraced in the women's community. And at the time, a lot of the women had been sort of, for many years, had been opening themselves up to other methods of expression of gender. And that had been going on for decades, of course, you know, going back to 1979 and Sam Wan, Pat Califia, and all of these other people who are, you know, fucking gender within the, the community. I had no idea about any of this. So within the first 3 weeks of living there, I had been going to the Center for Sex and Culture, which no longer exists, and hanging out at Wicked Grounds, which no longer exists, and all of these dungeons that don't exist anymore. And I wound up sort of going through more of a traditional sort of initiation into the kink lifestyle.
Which you think no longer exists. Is that what you're saying?
I don't say that. I think that leather has become a lot more accessible to a lot of people. And I think at the time that I entered it, it wasn't necessarily accessible to a lot of people. And I happened to have the good fortune of being taken under the wing by a bunch of folks from specifically in San Francisco, like Miss San Francisco leather pageant folks, a whole bunch of sober leather people, a lot of people who had come up in that scene and been around for a while. And so I went to a lot of courses. I learned a lot of things. The person who founded this San Francisco bootblack sash, I dated her for a while. And she was the person who more than anyone really sort of brought me in and just sort of taught me the old traditions. I wound up doing just a lot of research because I found it fascinating because it was an entire subculture of queerness that I really was unaware of. I was unaware of how politically active it had been, especially during the early HIV/AIDS era, and how so many of these people had to literally hide themselves because of the stigma that we face today against people who are into kink. And, you know, things like the concept of gifting people leather, the concept of earned leather, and like earning flags and handkerchiefs rather than like, you know, just, you know, of course you can go to Mr. S or the Leatherman or whatever and like go and buy all your gear and be fancy. But that's also, you know, not necessarily the way it always was, nor should it be. There's this concept that existed for many years where it's like, okay, you're poor, you're broke, you're coming to a new place, let's hook you up. And like some of my most prized things are gifts of leather that have been given to me or pieces of leather that I've found in secondhand shops like Worn Out West or, you know, things that have been handed down to me. And that concept, I don't see people talking about that as much as people talk about, hey, let's, you know, like beat each other up and pee on each other or whatever. And I'm like, that's not just the point.
Yeah, but peeing on someone is like gifting, right?
Yes, of course it is. But I think, you know, learning these consent-based rituals and learning all this stuff, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and diss the entire San Francisco leather scene because it still exists and it's still rich and wonderful. But I certainly, in the time that I have existed within San Francisco leather scene, I've seen literally almost every place that I would spend my time disappear. You know, it's very hard to see, and all the friends I've lost in that time period.
So could we go back?
Yeah.
And can I ask some like really naive, stupid questions?
Of course.
And can you just humor me?
Absolutely.
And I'll start off with one of those questions that the answer I assume is just, I just knew. But like, how did you know that you were into kink? Like, what was the inkling? What was the seed?
I think the seed was, you know, I always liked leather. And at a certain point, you know, I read the same books everybody else did in the 90s and the 2000s. And like, I was just like, oh, this sounds interesting. I would meet people, you know, sex partners who were, you know, like, have you tried this thing? But I think I have a very distinct memory of being a child, like 10 or so years old, and somebody giving me a beautiful, like, vegetable tanned leather wallet. And I just couldn't stop smelling it. And I was like, I don't know why, this brings me a lot of joy and a lot of comfort. You know, and I always like wore leather, and I always like was into sort of the culture of like, you know, leather looks cool, and I always wore boots and whatever. And then when I came into this scene and I met other people, like this person I'm talking about, like her father's a preacher, my father's a rabbi, we both shined our father's shoes on the weekend, and then like we find out that there's like, you know, when we were children, and like
the fact that there's like entire like fetishes built around stuff like that, you know, stuff that got embedded very early on. Not saying I have daddy issues. That's not the point. daddy's a gender neutral term. But yeah, I would say but becoming self-aware of it, probably about 15 years ago, I was just like, there's some things that I'm into, like bite my neck, you know.
But so if you came to that realization 15 years ago, what prevented you from pursuing it?
I think I tried to pursue it. I definitely walked into some scenes in New York and I just didn't feel like comfortable. Maybe it was the people that I was around. I wasn't sort of embedded in that scene. And I think the thing that I was focusing on more was sort of decolonizing the fact that like me being a woman, because I was transitioning around the same time, was not a fetish, was not kink. It was just who I was.
Yeah,
you know, so I would say that that's probably one of the reasons that I just like dissociated from that, you know, or distanced myself from that rather, because I was trying really hard to just sort of like get into myself and my body. And later on, when I sort of wound up being in the middle of all of these trans women doing like heavy BDSM, all of a sudden I'm just like, oh shit, this is a way to be in my body as myself. And it existed back then in New York. I just didn't find it. And I'm fine, you know, it's like, I know those folks now. They're my friends, you know, but yeah, I it wasn't for lack of trying. It wasn't the time. And I think sometimes that's the way it is for queer people, that, you know, it's just not the time. And as much as I'm a person who rails against the closet, you know, people, but I'm like, as soon as you figure out you're in a closet, you should come the fuck out of it.
Really? Oh, let's unpick this. So do you think that for everyone?
I think that, you know, it is great. There's great power in coming out, and that like if every closeted kid in a repressed Midwestern community came out and was just like, "Dad, I'm fucking gay. You're going to fucking deal with it. Also, I've locked up the guns." there's things, you know, I sometimes get criticized because on Coming Out Day, which just passed, I often say, "You have to come out. That is the challenge. You have to come out. It's really fucking important. There are reasons why it's important. And it's important because I need you to come out for me, to make the world safer for me and for you and for all of us, you know, because when everybody comes out, you know, it becomes a safer place. And then you know, and then you have like a place where you can't come out, you know. The point is that there's a lot of us. You can't defeat queerness.
No, yeah, I think, I mean, I think I had that quite, I'm going to say militant, but it's not militant, but that kind of definite point of view when I was earlier in that, like, there is a need because you need to be yourself and you need to be making space for yourself by letting people know and by coming out. But I think I've kind of softened a bit as I've aged.
Like a fine wine, darling.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that. Like a bottle of turpentine. Have a bit more of an understanding of different people's experiences.
Yeah, I mean, look, I would never say come out if there's, you know, a chance of you getting destroyed or killed. I would say get the fuck out. Come here so we can help protect you. And that's unfortunately what's happening in the United States right now. A lot of people are leaving, they're escaping, and a lot of people are staying put and fighting.
Yeah.
It's a really strange time, and I don't have to tell you in the UK, it's equally messed up. And
terrifying, yeah. So I've taken us off a little bit. So let's go back to you showing up in San Francisco, 2015. You were just out of a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Was there like a particular plan other than let me just get a fresh scene, let me just figure my shit out?
No, it's like, let me get a fresh scene, let me figure my shit out.
Okay. And so like dipping your toe into the scene, because you mentioned before that that happened quite quickly. How did you find your way there?
How did I find my way there? It's so long ago now. I just started showing up. People were like, show up to this thing, meet this person. I remember the very first thing I did. The very first thing I did was I met this person named Fel, who was a trans writer. and we had been talking about starting like a poets group between Thel and this other person I know. I'd gotten tickets to see Corel at the Castro Theater during the Frameline Film Festival. They're like, hey, go see this movie. And I walk into this movie. I was like, what is this? And then somebody else was like, you know, there's a talk back at the Center for Sex and Culture. And I walked into the Center for Sex and Culture. I was like, and I'm like, there's books on things. And then there are all these people that I knew who were writers on trans theory and kink theory who just, and like, because there's a big Venn diagram that overlaps there, who were speaking at the CSC. And I just showed up. And then I met other people. And I just was like drawn to these people, you know, and then I met this girl, Tegan, who, you know, who I frankly fell head over heels for. And, you know, she's like a motorcycle driving dyke.
What is not to love?
Yeah. And I was like pretty well known on like Twitter and Facebook for being like an activist and like, you know, for having come out publicly the way that I had, you know, so like people kind of quote knew who I was, but they also just like knew me as a human. So like, you know, I knew a lot of these people from online, and then it was just like, I often joke, oh, the internet came to life, and it did. And, you know, I wound up spending a lot of time with Tegan learning about leather and going to all of these different spaces and, you know, going to the Eagle and being like, oh, this is a men's space. You know, this is how we're expected to act in this men's space. But also like, you know, don't let anybody fuck with you. And like, this is, you know, how we do stuff. And we go like, do all of these like courses on consent and like different kinds of play. And I just start meeting people, you know, and it was just this really fascinating thing. And I think that there's this tendency for people to become more closed off these days, especially because of the pandemic. People tend to just like close off and do their own thing. And like, so doing things in public and like talking to people and just seeing how people lived, going to like the leather stores, meeting people who did leather, joining a band that was like, you know, run by like all of these like queer core legends. It all happened very quickly. And then like, you know, then I'm living in this beautiful old carpet warehouse with like 14 or 15 other queers and like fighting the man and doing all this stuff, and then like, you know, having these wonderful experiences like in my loft and learning from people and reading books and going to these kink events. And you know,
but there's something in that as well about when you're new to an area, when you're new to a place, your guard is down less, right? And you are happier to experiment, are happier to just show up. And then on top of that, you're happier to explore things that you've not explored before because you're not worried about any of the hang-ups that come with other people that know you already finding out about that.
Yeah, it was certainly different. Like, you know, my world sort of exploded after my divorce and I just need to split New York, and I don't usually pull a geographic, but...
Wait, is pull a geographic a phrase that I should know? I mean, I know what you mean when you said that, but like, do people use that?
It's a term that people use in AA a lot, you know?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because it's like a change of scenery isn't necessarily going to solve your alcoholism.
Yeah.
I think being put into a relatively safe environment where I was able to experiment with myself for the first time, and where I wasn't, you know, I was afraid to go to gay bars, but I would go to gay bars like outside of like New York, like in New York, what if somebody saw me, you know, like, and, but I wasn't really even like self-aware enough or like able to be gay enough. I remember like one of the best nights of my life was like, I think it was like 2005 or six. I was visiting London and I first like started GAY, and then I was with some friends of mine who are queer, and then I went to like some big, huge mixed dance party, and I was like dancing with boys and dancing with girls and dancing with people who weren't boys or girls. And I was just like, this is magical and wonderful. And then I flew home right back into like, you know, pretending to be something I wasn't, which is not even the right term. You know, I wasn't even pretending. I was just stuck in a life. But yeah, something that I mourn a lot is like being in New York and realizing, and even being in San Francisco and realizing that there were things that I could have been doing with people in certain places or people that I'd literally overlapped with. Sometimes in like pictures, somebody would be like, oh, hey, remember this day? And I'd be like, oh my God, these are like three of my friends now in this picture from like, you know, 2000 and whatever. And like, it was always there. But like, it was in San Francisco where people really guided me through that door.
And you mentioned before that it was a safe environment for you to be in. Mm-hmm. Why was it safe?
I felt very taken care of. I felt very protected. There were people there who knew I was new, who wanted to make sure people didn't take advantage of me, who looked after me. I mean, as a grown-ass adult, but like, there's also this sort of like, I was like under the wing of like some people who were like heavy hitters, literally, in the King scene. And, you know, so that was just this instant, like, oh, this both gravitas and the whole like, hey, can I talk to you? Or like, and then like, some of these people who became my partners, who are very, very respected people within that scene.
Mm. So you mentioned Tegan before. Tegan your mentor? Is mentor an appropriate word?
I would say Tegan was my entry point into like the formal King scene, because I was watching her sort of learn and prepare. She was teaching me all of these things and all of this history and would take me to all of these events because she was going out and doing things all the time. And we were dating for a while. I was her girlfriend for a while. And then, you know, that fell apart. That was fine. We're still friends, whatever. But yeah, there was definitely a bit of a mentee aspect to that. And then there were other people I was dating concurrently mm-hmm. who were also teaching me things. And I just really enjoyed being, you know, I think for a lot of my life, I had allowed people to put me in very dominant roles, and I didn't want to be in dominant roles, you know. And I got to experience what life was like on the other side of that. And, you know.
So can I pick up on a statement you just made, allowing people to put you in dominant roles?
Mm-hmm.
So people made assumptions about you, and then you didn't correct them, is probably not the right term, but you didn't assert a position.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think when I thought I was a straight person, a straight heterosexual, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, I was, you know, enforced cishet stuff is terrible.
Heteronormativity.
Yeah, it's awful. And, like, I think I was expected to be a certain way by a lot of people until I started dating somebody from San Francisco who's like, I see you. You're not quite the thing that you make yourself out to be. I'm like, oh, yeah, babe. Yeah, no, it was a very, very interesting thing where, and I think a lot of people do that. I think a lot of people, you know, who are powerful people, not powerful like, oh, I'm a mogul, but like people who just like spin magic or whatever are often people. You can be subservient to a dominant role in your life and not be happy about it, whereas you can allow yourself to, like, you know, there's nothing in the world more beautiful than like a very, very self-aware and powerful bottom.
nothing at all.
I don't know. To be a good bottom, you gotta know what you want. You gotta be able to talk. You gotta be able to assert yourself.
Oh, do you?
If you don't, then it's not consensual.
But if your role is submission.
Yeah. Submission doesn't mean like I'm going to sit there and take whatever you give me. It means we're going to have a conversation about what that means. If I'm going to cede control over my body, whether sexually, physically, or emotionally, psychologically, there have to be limits. And I also need to be able to say no. Like I've always said, you know, in order to be a really good top, you got to be a really good bottom because, you know.
Yeah, you need to understand what that's like.
Yeah.
But if your role is to submit, mm-hmm. like if your goal is to submit and that's what you want to like achieve through that union. Oh, I'm using terrible language today, sorry.
We're not just talking about sex. We're talking about kink too. We're talking about like in life,
yeah,
you know, as well as, you know,
yes, yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
The expanded idea of bottom and top. We're not just talking about like penetration and stuff like that. We're talking about a lot of things.
Yeah. Yes, but I think I might have lost the thread of what I was saying. Sorry. I think there is the consent, there is the permission, there is the agreement that you're able to say no to something that you may have already said yes to.
Yeah.
But if your goal is to feel as though you've submitted. Yeah, I think I've completely lost what I was talking about.
Sorry. Let me put it to you this way, and maybe we should move on. It's like, there is nothing more satisfying to me than like basically breaking a top and somebody just being like, shit, I have to stop. It's just too much.
Well, and breaking a top because your limit.
Because I'm a brat, dear. because I'm a
fucking
But
they can't
dad.
Push your limits, or?
It's hard to push my limits. And that's the thing. It's like, I'm a really, really, really good, I'm really good at what I do. And I'm also a really good top, you know, but the point is that, like, yeah, it's a really interesting dynamic, you know. It's like, yeah, I really get off on the idea of like a power exchange and a power dynamic and like being in, quote, submissive role, but still having power.
Mm-hmm. But so how do you break them? Just by like keep saying more?
I'd be saying, is that all you got? And, you know, sometimes that is, you know, all, sometimes that is all they got. But like, just, I'm being funny here, but like, I'm a limit seeker, and I've always wanted to test the limits of what, you know, my body and my mind can do. And I've always walked that edge, and it's very important to me.
Mm.
But in order to do that, I needed to do that in a really safe environment. And so for me, you know, some of the spaces that have disappeared are like supervised kink spaces that are sober, you know, and things like that. Places where I feel inherently safe and inherently taken care of. And like those spaces still exist. People who like are going to walk through and just see, is everything okay? Is everything okay? Are you okay? You know, just like, but, you know, I got to live through sort of the tail end of a very specific era of mainstreamed queerness in San Francisco. And I'm very grateful for that. There's a lot of comfort in that, in knowing that I could, in, I always had a fear of these spaces and then going into them and like queering them in my own way and being accepted was great. And then you have places like The Stud, which is what we were originally supposed to talk about. It was just like our clubhouse. Like that was like the outsiders clubhouse. That's where we all hung out. That's where we had New Year's. That's where, you know, I recorded videos there. I kissed people. I like, you know, did poppers on the dance floor for the first time there. You know, it's like things like that. All the Aww. Things you see in movies and whatever. And, you know.
So you have expertly brought us onto The Stud, even though that was my job. And we're now like, what, an hour into our conversation? Mm. No, not quite.
Copying from the bottom.
Can I ask you, if you remember the first time you ever went to The Stud?
Hmm. I don't remember the first time I ever went to The Stud. I remember the first time I ever danced at The Stud.
Ooh, tell me about it.
It was, I joined a band called The Homobiles, which is Lenny Breedlove from Tribe 8 and Ed Varga of Homo Ogogo and a lot of other people from, you know, we built ourselves as a queer party super group. And we'd done like a video there. And I can't remember if this is before or after the video. It's probably well before, but I just remember just walking in my leathers and like just like this glittery dance floor. And there were all these people that I'd seen from like picnics or like Pride or whatever. And I just like walked in and like they're playing like, you know, I don't know, they're probably playing like Sylvester or something. It just felt like the 70s. And I just walked in and just like was dancing with people. And there was a drag show and, you know, and I'm throwing dollar bills at people. And then like, and we all started dancing, and I just remember being really close to this beautiful woman and just being all tight and close with her. And she's wearing a pink dress and she's got long blonde hair. And she's also a trans woman. We're all just like being all cute with each other. I think maybe we kissed a little bit. I don't remember. And just like she busts out a bottle of poppers and we're just like getting real close to each other. And it was just really freaking cute. I don't remember much of anything else. I'm sure other hilarity ensued. But after a while, you know, it became one of these things where it's like The Stud was the place I would go when I didn't have anything else to do. I would just go to The Stud because I always felt welcome.
So before we get on to that, you've described what happened. Describe how that felt.
I felt so embraced and like looking around at all these people, many of whom I knew. And everybody was smiling at me. Nobody was judging me. And I just felt like I was just, I felt home. I felt like I was in a place that just felt absolutely like home. Like I was supposed to be there. Like I'd always been there. And just knowing that like all of a sudden I am part of queer history. I'm here in this place at this time. And it just was this very self-aware thing of like, this is awesome. And I'm part of it. And I get to be part of it. And that's such a privilege and a joy.
And sorry, I cut you off. So from there, it became the place that you went to when you had nowhere else to go.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, because, you know, you'd pass the stud, you know, I drive, or at least I did at the time, and it was very convenient to go to the stud, or like I'd be organizing just up the street at this warehouse, and then afterwards we'd go off to the stud and just hang out. There was always something happening, and usually it was a friend of friends of ours, like some organization like St. James Infirmary or Transgender Justice Initiative. There'd be some fundraiser going on. So, you know, you'd just show up, or somebody would be like, oh, this is my party. This is what's going on tonight. And it just became the place where it's like, if I didn't have anything to go, I would just show up there. I'd sit there. I'd drink like a tequila sunrise and just like hang out with my friends and talk. Then inevitably I'd start getting ready to leave and somebody else would walk in, and I'd be like, oh, I'll talk to them for a while. And then somebody else would walk in and I'd be like, oh, I'll talk to them for a while. And then, like, you know, and then meet somebody and maybe they'd go home with me. Maybe they wouldn't, you know, but it was like the stud was always the place we wound up. And it was also the place that I just could feel like I could go into at any time, like that I was completely and totally welcome, that it was a place for me. And like, I knew the people who worked the door and like, you know, and just hang outside and smoke cigarettes if I didn't have any money, you know, whatever.
And you mentioned before, I can't quite remember the exact words you used, but that it was a place for outsiders.
Yeah. You know, I mean, there are other bars certainly in San Francisco that are just like, you know, there are lesbian bars. Well, there's a lesbian bar now, Wild Side West, and, you know, there's the Eagle and all these other bars. And the stud always just felt like a bar where it was just like, yeah, it was a place where outsiders, just like people who were just queer, it was a queer bar. It wasn't a gay bar, even though like it was originally like, you know, it was originally on Polk Street and part of the whole hustler scene back in the day in the 60s and 70s before it moved down to Soma. But it wasn't like necessarily a leather bar. It was just like, you could show up there however the hell you wanted. And like, you were part of the scene. Mm-hmm. And there was just such cool stuff happening all the time. And it's just, it was our space. It was the place that taught me, honestly, it was the place that taught me that, like, you know, I used to be one of those people who was like, oh, well, you know, don't equate trans stuff with drag stuff. Because you shouldn't, you know, being trans is different than doing drag. But like, it was the place that taught me that I'm like, oh, wait a second. You know, I've been having a very narrow view of the fact that like, drag queens are my sisters too, you know, in this fight for equity. And like, they're coming for all of us. And it was like, it was really a humbling thing, because I was just like, oh, here are people I admire because of what they're doing within the community outside of like anything else. This is like the queer community. And it was beautiful.
And so what was your response when you found out that it was closing?
Well, it was funny because I was there New Year's Eve 2020. Like, that was the place to be. And it was just magic. I was like, because they came out at midnight, Honey Mahogany, who's like, she was on Drag Race, and now she's like part of the Democratic Club in San Francisco, a very famous person who's also like, you know, a wonderful friend and also a co-owner of the stuff. It's like, comes out on stage and is like, we just got another lease on the building for another year. We've got a year to figure this out. And isn't this going to be great? And we're like, yeah, best year ever. 2020 is going to rock. And like, everybody's like making out with each other on the dance floor. And everybody's like high on mushrooms. And like, it was just beautiful. And like, you know, it's just this glorious, wonderful moment. And then like,
spoiler warning.
Spoiler alert, 2020. And then, you know, it became obvious that they couldn't keep the building.
But, okay, so.
How did I feel?
Yeah, how did you feel?
I was heartbroken. I had already lost so many spaces that had meant so much to me, the Center for Sex and Culture, the Lobot Gallery where I'd lived. I couldn't show movies anymore at ATA, which is the theater on Valencia Street where my small cinema collective showed movies. All of these places had shut down and very few of them reopened. But when the stud closed, it really felt like the end of an era, and like an era that I really didn't have a lot of time. You know, I remember talking to so many of my friends who were like, the stud is what influenced me to do this particular part of my life. And like for me, it was like this place where I just really felt like, you know, I walked in and it wasn't like I walked in and it was like, you know, everybody was like, hey. It was just like I walked in and it was just like, I'm comfortable. I'm a face in this crowd, but I belong in this crowd and people know that I'm here. Mm. It wasn't like walking to a bar and everybody's like, Mia. It was like walking to a bar and just feeling comfortable and like being able to just sort of like be part of a thing.
Mm. Yeah, that magical combination of feeling invisible but not feeling overlooked.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I still pine for that. Mm. It's hard to find. Is I think that for me as a public person, it continues to be hard for me to go somewhere and like feel completely at ease and like I can talk to anybody, like in a place where I don't know people and they don't know me. Or I feel like I'm in a place where like I walk in and instantly I'm on, you know? And so yeah. The stud was this wonderful median for me where I could just be who I was and not have to perform unless I was performing.
Perform as in live up to people's expectations of you.
Yeah. You know, I mean, okay. Being a public figure is an interesting occupation. I think people assume that, like, you know, people either treat you like you're untouchable or they think you're too busy for them. I'm not going to make assumptions about all the people. This is just my experience. There have been a lot of times in my life where people have treated me like, you know, I'd be like, why aren't you inviting me to stuff? They're like, oh, I thought you were too busy. Or I walk into a place and instantly everybody's attention is on me. And like, I'm just like, I just want to be your friend. I don't want to be the center of attention.
And with music, do you find that people have an expectation that you'll be really like deep and like intense all the time?
I do think that actually, that's a very good way of putting it. I think people expect me to be just like on. They just expect me to be on. And, you know, there's a difference between the me that's on stage and the me that's like, you know, watching like anime in my underpants. There's a huge difference.
Well, yeah, because it just takes up so much energy to be like that hyper aware, right? Like, to know everything that's happening around you and respond accordingly.
Right. And especially because so many of the, you know, it's like, I don't want to be misquoted. I don't want my work to be, you know, jeopardized by that. And I also like, you know, like there's an inherent power imbalance, you know, in being like a person, like people are like, oh, I bet you, you know, go out on the road and you like, you know, you go and you get laid a lot. I'm like, no, I actually very deliberately do not hook up with people after shows unless they're people I've known for years, because there's an inherent power imbalance in that. And I don't want to be in that situation. Mm. And I have to be aware of that, that there are people who are like, who are just like cowed by who I am. And I don't want to be, I don't want to be that person.
Well, because also you don't want to let them down. Like they don't, yeah, you don't want them to find out how terrible you are at sex.
Oh, you're silly.
No, but that is like a real thing, right? Like if they've put you on this pedestal, the only place you can come is off that pedestal.
I know. I just wrote a song recently where it's just like, don't put me on a pedestal because I'll fall.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, and it's really important. It's like, I need people to lift me up, you know, as a human being, but I don't need them to put me up because like, I can't live up to those expectations, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's too much.
It's too much.
Okay, so I like to end on a cheesy note.
Okay.
Are you okay with... Okay, brilliant. Fantastic. If you could have a conversation with the Mia who showed up in San Francisco in 2015, before the stud, before exploring the leather scene, what advice would you give her?
That's really deep. Be patient. You don't have to go as fast as you think you need to go. Let yourself be comfortable with yourself and find the people who really care about you and want to love you the way that you know you can love yourself. And then I give her a big hug and then I talk to her like at length about certain things that I don't want to discuss here. But you're going into some of the work that I was doing with my therapist this morning. So...
Oh. So maybe I shouldn't ask the follow-up question.
Go ahead.
What was she in a hurry? Where was she speeding towards?
She was speeding towards an idea of comfort and safety that wasn't necessarily the one that I think that was the one that she would want. And it got her into a lot of pain. You know?
And what do you admire most about her?
That she survived. That she got me here.
Do you have any memories of the stud? Or maybe clubbing from your own queer scene that you want to share? Well, if you do, I would love to hear all about it, so why not get in touch? I want to create the biggest online record of people's memories and stories of queer clubbing, but I need your help in order to do that. Why not go to lostspacespodcast.com and find the section Share a Lost Space to tell me all about what it is you've been getting up to. And if that's all a bit too much and you just want to reach out and say, hey, why not get in touch on Instagram or on Facebook, where you can find me as Lost Spaces Pod. To find out more about Maya, why not follow her on Instagram, where she is Maya Byrne, Facebook, where she is Maya Byrne Music, or on X, where she is Ms. Maya Byrne, and that's MS. Just go to the show notes. You'll see them all there. That's much easier than me spelling everything. If you enjoyed this episode, I would really appreciate if you took the time to subscribe, leave a review on your podcast platform, or just tell other people who you think might be interested in giving it a little listen too. My name's Kay Anderson, and you have been listening to Lost Spaces.